Hello, Dr. Ivana Ransky. It's a pleasure to have you today on Research and Beyond, a podcast dedicated to making researcher journey easier. Thank you so much for accepting my invite and being a part of the podcast today.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
Great. And today, as we speak of science and research, we can't just take everything at face value, as everyone would agree here. There needs to be a system of checks and balances, someone keeping an eye on things and making sure everything is above board. That's where science journalism comes in. And when I think of them, one name that pops in my mind without a second thought is of you, Dr. Oransky. While I'm particularly intrigued in your current role as the editor-in-chief of The Transmitter, and the distinguished journalist in residence at New York University's Carter Journalism Institute, I strongly believe that your efforts in teaching the next generation of medical journalists must be immensely rewarding.
Oh, it's very rewarding to teach students, mostly because I learn probably more from them than I teach them. It's a great privilege to be able to do that, and I've been doing that for almost half my life, for actually, for more than two decades. And every year I learn something new. So it's really terrific.
That's commendable. And also your journey from, earning a medical degree at NYU to becoming a globally recognized voice in science communication is remarkable, in my opinion, for someone who has been in the industry for only 5 years now. That's me. So it's really inspiring to look at your journey in that area. And of course, we can't discuss your accomplishments without mentioning Retraction Watch, who I have been following day and night. The groundbreaking initiative, as I may call it so, that you co-founded to promote accountability and integrity in scientific research. It has undoubtedly transformed the landscape of scholarly publishing in ways more than one, I would like to believe.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm very kind to say that. I generally leave it to other people to say whether or not we've had an impact. I hope we have, but really, we're just trying to tell stories and document what's going on. And if that's helpful, that's terrific.
Absolutely. So today, as we speak and unravel some intricacies and unknown facts of investigative journalism, I'm eager to dive into your perspectives on the evolving role of journalism in safeguarding scientific rigor, exposing misconduct, and fostering public trust in research, especially in this AI advent times. So thank you again for being here, Dr. Oransky.
Oh, good to be here.
To begin with, I would like to ask you and take people back to where you started from. So from having to attend Harvard to becoming one of the most influential science journalists, could you please take us through your journey in short and what influenced your interest in this area?
Sure. And again, I don't know that I'm one of the most influential science journalists. I can think of a lot of people who've done a lot of important work who are certainly better known. But I appreciate that. I was interested in journalism ever since I was really an early adolescent, probably around 10 or 11 years old. I was reading the New York Times, and there was a reporter then. He was there for 40 years, named Lawrence Altman, and he was able to use his medical degree to do amazing reporting, really insightful reporting. And, so I got interested in journalism then, particularly medical, science and medical journalism, and was very involved in my high school newspaper, my college newspaper. In medical school, I was the editor, co-editor-in-chief of the medical student section of JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association. So I've sort of always done this. At some point I decided to do it full time. That was about 25 years ago. And so I don't practice medicine. Never have. I finished medical school, but decided to, after my internship, that first year of training, I been in journalism full time ever since then.
Yes, that's absolutely inspiring also, because a lot of people taking academic studies and getting into a profession, deciding that that will be their vocation later on, but eventually end up into doing something else that interests them the most. So when you took up journalism as your profession or something that interested you, you may have come across a lot of instances where there may have been certain high-profile cases or, certain situations where you may have to protect the whistleblowers. So how do you manage doing that while you're reporting misconduct?
Well, I think, I mean, it is very important to protect whistleblowers, but not all whistleblowers need protection. Sometimes they're actually powerful people who are calling it, calling attention to problems in literature. There are ways to keep people anonymous. I think that journalists, and I trained as one. I really trained as one of my college newspaper. We learn how to do those things. There's never 100% security in anything, but there are ways to again protect sources. But I think the most important thing is to be honest with them and to give them a sort of informed consent about what might happen. Despite whatever efforts I may make, and we make considerable efforts to protect anonymous sources, that doesn't necessarily protect people. Sometimes people make what they don't realize are mistakes in terms of their social media profiles or other profiles. So I would say there are a lot of times where we actually end up not pursuing stories because when we talk to people who bring us stories who are often very frustrated with the way the system works, because most people don't like to admit mistakes and a lot of people threaten lawsuits and what have you and other kinds of retaliation. And often people will say, I didn't really appreciate all of those potential risks. So, thank you. I don't think I want to move forward. And we respect that. We, if there's publicly available information that we can obtain without putting anyone at risk, we of course do that. But often the kinds of information that we need to pursue a story really could only be obtained through certain means that basically would out the whistleblower, the person who knows that. And so, we do what we can.
Yes, absolutely. I completely agree with what you said. And it's not always that sometimes the misconduct could be pretty unintentional as well. And in that cases, when the whistleblowers are something that they would not, as you mentioned, they would want to be anonymous in certain cases. And if the information is publicly available, be it so. But in this due process, how much of an impact has science journalism had in improving accountability and self-correction in science? Are people now afraid of the repercussions that they may have to face at whatever stage of career that they are at?
Well, I think that there is more acceptance and certainly visibility of platforms like PubPeer.com, which I'm on the board of directors of that organization, where people can leave comments often anonymously and often critically. And news outlets around the world are have been now writing about these cases. We, when we first started, when Adam and I co-founded Traction Watch in 2010. There were not a lot of people interested in this ma subject matter. I mean, there was some great reporting going on. There were even books about these subjects, but nothing all that consistent. People would episodically report on it. Now we see lots of reporters who, either see what we were doing or got, some other inspiration, and so it's more accepted. There continues to be pushback. People find reasons to. Object to an anonymity, for example. They find reasons to circle the wagons, as we say here in the States, around people accused of misconduct. And certainly there are some false allegations or allegations that were made even made in good faith and don't hold up. But the bigger problem is that too many journals and scientists and institutions and even governments continue to act as if none of the allegations were true, and that's really problematic. So, and again, whistleblowers and sleuths, which we call them, they're not all technically whistleblowers, but as whistleblowers, you have to be within an organization that is affected where you know it's happening. Some of the sleuths face, most of them are not paid, and they face, I'm not paid for traction loss either, that's a volunteer activity, but they face threats of lawsuits. Very rare that people actually file lawsuits, but when they do, that can be quite crippling financially. So I think people are aware of that, but many of them persevere because they are seeing how important it is to correct the record and to hopefully, therefore, bring back trust in science, which has taken some hits in the last several years.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And adding to your point, especially when it comes to, let's say, investigative journalism in medical and healthcare, journalists face a lot of numerous obstacles in their pursuit of healthcare stories, maybe legal hurdles, as you mentioned, lawsuits. Defamation laws is one of the reasons that probably sleuths are not really wanting to bring it up, which can also impede access to information and sources, if I'm right.
Well, if someone, responses to defamation lawsuits depend on the jurisdiction. Here in the States, truth is a defense for libel.
Correct.
So, it really behooves people who are going to get involved in this kind of work to understand what the libel laws are in their particular jurisdiction, and what protects them, and in fact, maybe even to obtain defamation insurance, which we have at Attraction Law. Very well-meaning and incredibly brave sleuths often, I think, don't have that kind of training, don't have that kind of background, and so it that can land them into trouble, not because they've actually done anything wrong, but because a lawsuit can be, as I mentioned, financially crippling. So I think that it makes sense to consult with someone about what you're doing when you're posting a blog or something like that. Not everyone will agree with me on that, and I respect that. We, in 14 years at Attraction Watch, have never been sued, and we have, on average, we've put up more than, I think it's something close to 7,000 posts now, most of which are about bad behavior or allegations of bad behavior, and we've never been sued. And so you can interpret that a few different ways. You could interpret it as we aren't really telling, the whole story that we could. And I suppose there's some element of that because we only publish what we can verify. Or you could say that we actually, Adam and I, because even going into this project, had well over a decade of experience each. And now we have well over 2 decades of experience each doing this kind of work and being journalists, that we understand what libel is. So I think it's really important to not only think about how to support your claims about a particular case after you're sued. You should actually be prepared and, almost act as if you could be sued at any time, which is true.
Yes, absolutely. And it's remarkable to know that, in the journey of Retraction Watch so far, the Retraction Watch has never had to face any of these instances, and that's amazing. That just guarantees the kind of investigation that goes into reporting something. It's not just off the bat kind of an information or, releasing a press release, for example, out of an institution or whatever. I believe there goes an intricate level of investigation that goes into it and reporting these instances. I recently came across this news on Retraction, about Retraction Watch, that the database has recorded over, I think, 47,000 retractions recently. And now today, when you record and report 40, over 40,000 plus retractions, what was, when you go back and think about the inspiration behind founding Retraction Watch in 2010, what was that like? What instigated you to, oh, I need to find this out?
Well, Adam Marcus, again, my co-founder, he had broken a really big story about scientific misconduct, about clinical trial misconduct. Someone named Scott Rubin, who had faked all of the data in his clinical trial. And when I read his stories about this in 2008, 2009, I was at Scientific American at the time. We actually picked up one of those stories and did our own story, and of course with credit to Adam's amazing work. And it made me think that there were lots of good stories hiding in plain sight, but people were not writing about these because I hadn't been hearing about them. I knew what retractions were. I had re reported about a few of them here and there, but I hadn't really done a careful study. I hadn't really pushed on this. And so Adam and I would talk about this case and about other cases we'd see. And eventually in 2010, I went to him and said, what if we wrote a blog about it? And so, the inspiration really was Adam's work and the sort of what made us think that there was something that we would occasionally write about was that there were retractions all the time. We also noticed that the retraction notices were often either unhelpful or misleading, and we thought that was a bad thing for science. And so we didn't actually think about the database for some years. So probably about within a year or so, maybe a year or two, Adam and I realized that we couldn't keep up with, all the retractions anymore. There were far more of them than we thought. And they also weren't being recorded in all the databases that they should have been. And so, in 2014, foundations began calling us and saying, you're doing interesting work that we think deserves some support. What would you like to do? It's a wonderful kind of call to get. And we said, well, what the world really needs is a complete, comprehensive, and fact-checked and verified database of retraction. So we embarked on that with some very generous funding from a few foundations and launched it in 2018. And then last year, 5 years after we launched the database, and at the time that we last year when this happened, there were about 44,000 retractions in it. Now there are about 48,000. It was acquired by Crossref, which is another nonprofit. We're a nonprofit as well. And now it's freely available, and we have sustainability for that part of what we do. We're continuing to maintain it. Everything stays the same, except that it belongs to Crossref and is part of their data now. And I think that's a recognition that this was something the world needed, that publishers weren't really doing the way they were supposed to, and that, the databases that should have had those data, those metadata, didn't have access to them because the publishers weren't doing what they were supposed to.
Yes, and definitely, like when you said that, what inspired you into when Adam Marcus also started, note kind of reporting these instances, and then you all came up with the whole blog idea. Post that, like now over a decade later, after co-founding it together, and then receiving the kind of funds that you received, the recent, Crossref acquiring Retraction Watch's database. Can we say mission accomplished with what intent that Retraction Watch was founded initially?
I think there have been some important strides. I think there's been progress, but mission accomplished is way far off. And I don't know if we'll ever get there. I think the mission is to, the real mission is to, cut down on waste and, bad behavior if possible in science. That's a much bit larger mission than simply, research integrity, improving research integrity. That's a much larger mission than creating a database, as much work as that was. So no, I don't believe we're anywhere near mission accomplished. I think there's been some important progress, and I think we should all be take stock of that, and otherwise it becomes, like Hercules. I think, I don't think we should say mission accomplished.
That's really humble of you, but also agreed that, even after exposing several cases of research misconduct so far, there still are certain ethical violations happening in scientific literature that we are not completely gotten rid of. In that area, what are some of the biggest ethical lapses or forms of misconduct you see occurring in research, and what are the current challenges in mitigating them at the moment? So that, like, while we are trying to reach at the mission, we're somewhere there, we're leading a progressive life. But how can we, with the current challenges, how can we mitigate those?
Well, I think, I mean, there are lots of different kinds of misconduct happening. I mean, the one that's in the news a lot lately is paper mills, and people who are, acting unethically or even illegally by making use of paper mills or buying authorship. But that's, that I think we can, that can obscure, the interest in that can obscure what's been going on for years in terms of manipulating images, in terms of plagiarism, in terms of sort of p hacking and other sorts of problems in the literature, analytical problems, QR or known as QRPs, research practices that are not Q, they're not quality. So I think that we have to look the way upstream, because what's driving this behavior is the incentive structure. It's publish or perish. It's the overarching need to publish and therefore be cited, because universities want to increase their rankings, right? They want to improve their rankings. And that has, I think, led to, if not all, then the vast majority of bad behavior in science. It's hard to see how it wouldn't. And so what we really need to be doing, in addition, right, in addition to looking for the problems and doing something about them, is to look at why they're happening to begin with, and that we have to go way upstream. I use the metaphor of sewage getting into the ocean. We don't want sewage getting into the ocean. So we need to build sewage treatment plants at the mouths of rivers right before they get into the ocean. But we also need to go way upstream and look at why is raw sewage getting into the and pollution getting into streams and rivers to begin with, because if we don't do that, you can build all the pollution plants, excuse me, sewage treatment plants you want, you won't actually get to, you won't actually solve the problem.
I absolutely agree. And the way you mentioned that, it's necessary for us to identify where it begins at, right? We need to go upstream rather than just treating the sewage at the mouth of the rivers, right? When it's connecting to the ocean. So that's a very good metaphor, and I'm sure I'm going to use it somewhere. But when we talk about these different kind of misconducts that you mentioned, be it with in terms of having to pay for authorships or paper mills, and even the fear that especially young researchers have, which is in terms of publish or perish, are there certain disciplines that you may have come across in your experience where you tend to find higher rates of problematic behavior exposed when you investigate the process?
No, and I think I'm asked this question a lot. It's a natural question, but I would say that because we're only really investigating the process of
Correct.
whether things are happening or not, what I tend to say is that when I see fields that don't have that many attractions, I think it's because nobody's looking for problems. So the fields that have more attractions, it's generally because people are actually looking, and that's a good thing. And we shouldn't. If you punish more attractions, which is what a lot of people seem to want to do, and sort of point to attractions as a somehow meaning a field is in more shape, if you do that, all you'll do is, disincentivize correcting the record. You'll disincentivize attractions. So I think we need to normalize attractions. And again, if you look at fields, we have a ranking of all the people with the most attractions in the world. A lot of them, more than you would expect, are from anesthesiology. That's because anesthesiology, which had the problem that actually, story of which led to the creation of Attraction Watch, realized years ago that it had a problem, maybe before any other field, or at least at the same time as a couple other fields. And so they have more attractions. We should actually applaud that.
So in addition to my previous question, I also wanted to understand in terms of how has this scrutiny from the public or publishers and even funding agencies evolved with respect to the disclosure of retractions and instances of research misconduct?
Well, again, I think that there is just because there's so much more conversation about these issues happening, more people are coming forward. There's more opportunities for people to do that. Again, there's still some backlash. There's still some sort of attempts to say, well, it's just a few bad apples, or it's not a systemic problem. But in fact, it is, and I think people need to grapple with that if we're going to sort of improve things. But I do think that increased conversation is a good thing, and I think that look, the number of retractions has grown dramatically. We haven't talked about that here, but the rate of retraction went from about 1 in 5,000 papers 20 years ago to about 1 in 500 papers last year, and we think it should still be much higher, probably about 1 in 50 papers. But that increase is absolutely due to more people having the opportunity to point out problems, and to people actually doing something about it.
Yes, definitely so. And like earlier when you mentioned, that struck my attention when in 2023, when Crossref acquired Retraction Watchers database that we were earlier speaking of, beyond having to make the retraction database easily accessible to publishers, researchers, what other goals did Retraction Watch aimed to accomplish with this acquisition taking place?
Well, again, we did very much want to have open data. That's always been our goal. We just had to charge for it in order to be able to continue doing the work. But it also brought sustainability for our efforts. We now have a 5-year agreement. It included an acquisition fee and a 5-year agreement to continue operating the database, and to improve the database. Crossref has tools and resources that I don't know that we ever would have had, certainly don't have now. That will only improve the presentation, will only improve the data, improve the user experience and the capability. So this is a very exciting it was a very exciting announcement to be able to make.
Yes, and congratulations on that as well. It's definitely helping a lot of us, and especially funders and researchers overall, in better understanding where to go about and how what best practices could they follow in terms of maintaining research integrity. So we speak about AI's advent coming up soon, and the ECRs are resorting to AI more than experienced research, I would say. But to what extent can we trust AI systems to detect misconduct and research fraud? Is there any alternative?
AI is not the answer to finding research fraud and misconduct. People found research fraud and misconduct for years before AI was even, talked about in terms of research. So that's not the solution. The solution is to go way upstream again and actually look at the demand and look at why that's happening. The solution is not AI. If AI can be helpful, that's great. And I'm sure in some limited cases it can be, but I think that that will be a distraction from the amazing work and the critical work that people have already been doing, and we should be looking at that.
Yes. Thank you so much, Dr. Oransky. Thank you for your time. And that was, as promised, that was my last question. I really wanted to understand your take on AI. Have a lovely
Thank
day.
you. You too. You're welcome.
At the end of the day, science is supposed to be this objective, trustworthy pursuit of knowledge. But without journalists holding institutions, publishers, and individual researchers accountable, the whole system could start to crumble. Science journalism is what keeps everyone on their toes and maintains public confidence in the sciences. So, yeah, while they might not be doing the experiments themselves, these journalists play just as important a role in the scientific world. They're the referees making sure everyone plays fair and the whole game stays legitimate. Thank you, everyone, for listening to Research and Beyond. See you again next time.